Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
From the New Books Network, this is New Books in Geography. I'm your host, Dino Kadic, from the University of Cambridge. Two striking sentences open the book we're talking about today. Quote, "Learning time and space is like moving through a labyrinth. Paths are entangled, indirect, and often misleading." End quote. Safed Haji Muhammedovich is refreshing in his honesty and poetic in his prose as he leads us through this labyrinth, drawing lines between time, encounter, and landscape along the way. At the same time, he challenges some of the categories we as scholars take for granted, like ethnography, linear time, and academic writing itself. His book, Waiting for Elijah, Time and Encounter in a Bosnian Landscape, defies summary, so we might as well just get into it. Safet Haji Muhammedovich is Senior Teaching Fellow in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, and I'm so delighted he could join us today. Safet, welcome.
Thank you, Dino. I'm delighted to be able to participate in this podcast for New Books in Geography. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. So just to start out, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Of course. I currently teach anthropology of gender, specifically at SOAS, University of London. I have previously taught at several other universities, mostly the University of Bristol, but also at Goldsmiths, University of London, where I have completed my doctoral thesis. And the book that we're talking about today is actually based on my doctoral research. And that research and the interest in this particular topic stem from something that I've already started with my MPhil research in Cambridge, where you are right now. And it really is about a conundrum. How, faced with extreme violence, systematic violence in Bosnia, we can think of the richness, historical and present-day richness of encounters, of syncretic religion, shared and syncretic religion. And how do we reconcile these two seemingly opposing processes, social processes. The way this topic opened up for me was really through a question about syncretism and the way I found the kind of the geographical space, if you will, is really through a focus on one specific syncretic feast of Saint Elijah. It was really only through this focus on syncretism and what I thought would be originally a book about landscape and spatiality that time and temporality appeared to be inescapable. And so I have followed, in a way, really time rather than space, focusing on a particular annual cycle of religious feasts in the country, which are part of a much wider network of religious feasts in the Mediterranean and beyond the Mediterranean. So in that sense, Bosnia is not a specific case. And in this other sense of the nationalist dissociative violence, it is also not a special case. So this case study could very easily then be transported or transposed into many other contexts.
But there is something kind of singular about the place that you study, and I think you focus a lot on the field kind of as a really special place, and it seems to be a special place to you in the book. So can you tell us a little bit about the field of Gotsko and the characters that populate it, the mythological characters, the real characters, the people there?
Thank you. I'm glad that you also mentioned the mythological characters who are part of these conversations, and they populate the landscape, certainly. The field of Gotsko is a large flatland, a large space of contained karst in southeastern Bosnia, on the border with Montenegro. Now, karst is a very particular kind of landscape. It's a porous limestone landscape, of which there are many examples in Bosnia, Croatia, Montenegro, and along the Dinaric mountain chain. It's made up of limestone and porous rock, which also figures into the mythologies in numerous ways. In Gotsko, limestone starts off a phenomenon of Trebišnica, or a sinking river. This is a river which has, for the most part, flows underground, but then surfaces overground. Sometimes this is part of modernist projects which attempted to use its hydro potential. But every time it surfaces, it obtains a new name, and it has, I think, about 19 different names. And but the river itself is enigmatic and underground. And as I said, it starts off in this space of Gotsko. And it's intimately related with the cosmologies that I was talking about. And it really is those spaces where the river sinks into the earth that are boundaries between the world and the underworld in this cosmology. Now, I have referred for the most part to Gotsko, or the field of Gotsko, as simply the field. And for me, it's a specific space where I have spent a year of research, then venturing into other spaces as well. But it also is an analytical, a heuristic device to speak about a field of research and to speak about karst fields more generally and their associated cosmologies. So I wasn't that surprised when visiting Yucatan in Mexico to see that these sort of pits called cenotes in Yucatan are also spaces where the Mayan conducted their rituals associated with death. Gotsko, in that sense, this space can be noticed in, it has these peculiar connections through the non-humans. Now, my interlocutors appear throughout the book as much as I could sort of form it within the book through their own voices. And it really is mostly elderly people. Now, if I can paint the picture for those of you who haven't read the book, this large karst field is sort of, since the 70s, separated by a gigantic thermal power plant. a Yugoslav thermal power plant. This power plant was built because they're precisely because of the karst landscape, because there are rich lignite deposits underneath. And so there's this huge thermal power plant, and also the residue of the mines, which is another small mountain of white ash. Now, this mountain and this power plant was built on top of one of the central ritual places in the field, the place of Elijah's Day festivities on the 2nd of August. And it already intervened into the kind of the structure, the social structure and the ritual structure according to the annual cycle. In the middle of this field is also a town. There are many villages on the sort of fringes of the field, but in the middle there is a town. Now, this town in the 1990s, in what is referred to as war in Bosnia, Yugoslav wars, wars of the 1990s, and otherwise, this town was homogenized in an ethno-religious sense. This means that the non-Serb population was expelled and sort of formulated various kinds of communities outside of Gatsko, many diasporas in the United States, in Croatia, and also internally displaced populations within Bosnia. After the war, much of the property, or most of the property of quote-unquote non-Serbs has been sold off. So the town continues in that sense to be homogenized, even though, of course, I say quote-unquote because I'm not counting blood cells, but I'm thinking of the politics of ethnicity here. And in that sense, so this kind of ethno-political program was very much successful. My interlocutors were, on the one hand, the so-called returnees, and there is a ghostly sort of flavor to this word. The returnees, mostly elderly people who have returned to one part of the field, and mostly Muslim. In other villages, also elderly Serb interlocutors or Orthodox Christian interlocutors. I have also written about Gurbeti Roma communities, but I have written about them through the narratives of those Muslims and Christians whom I encountered, because the Gurbeti have not returned to the field of Gatsko. So perhaps that can be an answer to this question, and then we'll continue as we go through the other questions.
Yeah, so I'd love to talk about these ghostly presences, but I think first it might be good to speak a little bit about Elijah's Day and what it means. And I really enjoyed how you kind of implicitly compare the experience of waiting for Elijah to the characters in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, where everyone is kind of constantly waiting for something to happen that sort of materializes, but actually it's like the waiting that matters. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Thank you. Indeed, Waiting for Godot, Beckett's famous play, has appeared as an association, as I discovered, or the title of the book discovered the text of the book in a way. Waiting in the field for Elijah is at least double coded. In the traditional, in the structure of the traditional calendar, it is really the kind of the affective side of the annual cycle that appears as waiting. So as soon as one Saint Elijah's Day is over, waiting begins again. Why? Because it's the central locus. It's the central point in the annual cycle. The community, which is otherwise throughout the winter locked in heavy snow, and believe me, this is very heavy snow. One of the years, I think it was 2012, it was locked in snow so much that a helicopter had to be sent off with supplies for the villages, but then it crashed into the snow there. And one of my interlocutors would use these improvised skis to go from house to house. And it really is a long winter for which one needs to prepare. One needs to prepare throughout, you know, from the beginning of spring until St. Elijah's Day. And it really is St. Elijah's Day that marks the end of this strenuous summer labor. And it's a harvest feast. So it is a central location that is a mass get-together, an occasion for a social occasion which will not appear again until the end of summer. And so that this is where everything happens. This is where marriages would be arranged. This is where sort of singing groups of the kind of locally traditional forms of song, bechara, tsenganga, would perform. This is also where people or groups of men would enter into ritual fist fights. And this would happen very frequently, almost every year, not after the war. And it was explained to me as a release of energy that would otherwise, now imagine if you kind of do not release all the joy, happiness, but also the anger, and then you come to be locked inside your household throughout the winter, what would happen? That sort of energy would be released somewhere else. So it really is a social occasion par excellence. And it would be awaited throughout the year. Now, this is sort of the traditional waiting for Elijah. After the 1990s, after the community was violently restructured, those who have returned to the field and those who beckoned the old field of those get-togethers, they waited again for St. Elijah's Day, but now in a different way. They waited to wait the way they used to. So it's a double-coded waiting. They waited for the kind of waiting in anticipation of the social gathering. But this other kind of waiting was also, it was filled with hope, but also with dread. It was filled with uncertainty. The community, this large diasporic community, would return for one or a few days, and the field would suddenly resemble itself. And after that one day, the landscape would again fall silent, and it would be again filled with uncertainty and everyday forms of violence, really, for the returnees. And also, when I was there and even presently, the forms of nationalist disassociation of these religious forms and feasts and these communities continues into formations of exclusive ethno-religious national belongings.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think that's a really good jumping point into syncretism, which is something that you discuss throughout the book. And for you, I think you take a unique and thought-provoking view of syncretism as kind of a moment, right? As something that doesn't draw or like separate religions, right? That's my crude interpretation. So can you talk a little bit about how syncretism happens in the field and how that's changed?
Sure. So syncretism is one of those words which has its own histories, which are quite particular. And for quite some time, it was a word also avoided because historically it had also been used with connotations of certain sort of religious mixtures that were deemed improper by the church. So when I start writing about syncretism, it really is from this argument presented famously by Charles Stewart and Rosalind Shaw, where they say, well, you know, if we start pinpointing or discovering syncretism, we'll end up arguing that everything is syncretic in terms of religion, certainly. I mean, tell me one religion, religious form, ritual, and so on, which is not an amalgamation of different kinds of trajectories, histories, forms, and so on. There is none. And the same applies to language, culture, and so on. So discerning syncretism in that way would have been, for me, problematic to say, well, because this is a ritual in which Christians, Muslims, and Roma participate together, it is syncretic. However, Rosalind Shaw and Charles Stewart have introduced another term, anti-syncretism, or antagonism to religious syncretism, religious synthesis. And it really is through this antagonism, through this anti-syncretism, that I approached the question of syncretism in the field. It is really the nationalist anti-syncretic violence and the formation of sort of bounded, discrete, separated religious communities, or the idea that they could and should be produced, that suggested itself in contrast to the richness of shared concepts, sacred spaces, histories, and so on. So when I speak about syncretism in the field, it really is a focus primarily on proximity and encounter between those individual and social bodies and bodies of knowledge that are deemed to be dissociated by this antagonistic politics. So my focus is really on a certain anthropology of proximity, and in a conceptual sense, and in the sort of sense of these rituals as well, and in an everyday sense. And I follow there the writing a beautiful essay by one Edinburgh-based anthropologist called Hugues Fontaine, who wrote about or called for anthropology of proximity, noting that that really what we need to focus on, rather than reiterating and reasserting politicized differences on ever more philosophical, abstract, theoretical grounds, that we need to turn to certain proximities, coexistences, and continuities of people's material, historical, conceptual engagements. And this approach to proximity, to encounter, for me and for Fontaine, it does not deny the reality of dissociation. It does not deny the actuality of political and politicized differences, but rather it is a methodological tool to frame a methodological choice of how to start a conversation. And so it is a political choice, as any methodological choice would be in that sense.
So I wonder then, talking of proximity, I think that proximity and this kind of waiting to wait are really connected. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about kind of like the politics around that. And I'm specifically thinking of the Gurbeti, who have not been around for almost three decades now, but are still kind of a topic of conversation constantly, it seems like.
Yes, of course. So I have written about the Gurbeti Roma. Now, Roma is another one of those ethnonyms that needs to be unpacked. And it is not a singular certain, it's not a, it might seem like a reference to some homogenous community, but it certainly is not. There are many Roma languages, different kinds of Roma groups, and certainly traditions and histories. Gurbeti in the field are a particularly historically present group of Roma people who used to arrive early each spring and spend the warm season in the field. And their lives, as the lives of those who were settled in the field, were very much intertwined. So they mostly worked on kalaisanya, or the tinning of copper dishes. And copper dishes, for those who don't know, are considered to be the best kind of dish. And they're very durable, but they need to be maintained. And this maintenance takes a lot of effort, and it's a whole story that perhaps we don't have the time for now. But these gurbeti specialized in that, amongst other things. And this was sort of a way, this economy, where they offered the services of tinning copper dishes, was a way to form the social relations with the settled people. So Fata, one of my interlocutors, said, when Avdo, a Gurbeti man, would come, and he would come to, you know, every year, I would give him, prepare my copper dishes all ready for him, and he would arrive, I would say, in this tepsia, in this sort of large copper dish, I will, after you're done, bake a pie. And this pie will at once test whether the copper dish was properly maintained, properly tinned, but it will also be a compensation for the service, because it was mostly this local natural exchange where the settlers would give eggs, cheese, cooked food, and so on in exchange for these services. But it is really in that pie and in that copper dish and in this exchange that a certain historical and traditional forms of communication were sort of encapsulated. And so the proximity that was narrated between the settled people, Muslims and Serbs, and Gurbeti Roma appears everywhere. When I first arrived to the field of Gatsko, and before I even connected to most of the people who would then become my key interlocutors, I went through these various landscapes, and they seemed to me, to a large extent, desolate, you know, open, empty spaces, beautiful but empty. And it was really when one starts hearing these narratives about where the Gurbeti camps were established, the kinds of get-togethers for St. George's Day around the fire near the Gurbeti camps, these stories would populate the landscapes in a completely different way. And one would not be able to walk through those landscapes in the same way afterwards. And it is really this affective resonance of those narratives, of the laughter of my interlocutors when they would remember those get-togethers with the Gurbeti Roma, that would change the landscapes for me. And which, again, points, of course, to the importance of developing one's methodological tools to understand landscapes through long-term research, through intimate conversations. Landscapes are not something as such. Spaces are not something as such. They're when we attempt to objectify them in that way, distance them from those narrative stories, connections, we are imagining something else. It's a kind of imaginary that very often violates the forms of life in spaces that we research.
Yeah, and I think what you write then kind of troubles a lot of narratives in Bosnia about kind of who, quote, rural people are, and how they act towards other people, I guess. And it's interesting that you said that most of your interlocutors were older people who also, I think, there's a certain image of them, at least in contrast with younger people, as kind of they are the ones who are nationalist or who committed violence. And young people and urban people are anti-nationalist. And so I wonder kind of how you approach that, if that was something that you expected, and how like these disruptions affected the way you saw these landscapes.
Thanks. Certainly there was a difference between this small urban space of the Gatsko town and the villages, in the sense that the town embodied a certain ethos of nationalism. It was, as I mentioned, sort of a quote-unquote ethnically cleansed space, whereas the villages saw some very modest return. Now, this return also relates to the availability of interlocutors to a certain sense. The returnees were mostly elderly. The younger people who already formed new lives in various diasporic spaces. And so they would visit mostly for Elijah's Day, these diasporic communities. Sometimes they would come to visit their grandparents and so on. But it was for the most part the returnees who were elderly, and also in the Orthodox Christian villages, it was mostly elderly people because of the large scale migration of people for work, also the so-called brain drain into various other countries. So what we see, perhaps for different reasons, in the Muslim and the Orthodox Christian villages is really that the elderly people occupied those spaces for the most part. And the elderly people were also the ones who, throughout their lives, understood very much what the annual cycle means as a structure for the community. They embodied it. And they also, in rare cases when younger people were present, they would very much attempt through didactic narratives to translate this kind of knowledge of living in the field, knowledge of living with the seasons and the importance of those encounters. They would make sure to translate that knowledge and transfer it to the younger ones. So one of my interlocutors, one of my rare younger interlocutors, really in the village of Kula, Edo, he would tell me narratives that I later understood were absolutely impossible through his to have been gathered through his experience. He left, or he was expelled, together with his family from Gatsko when he was just a baby, several months old. And in this moment of that violence, when they had to flee, his grandmother, and the word grandmother in Bosnian language can be nana, nena, but also baba is one of those words. His grandmother took Edo, this little baby, in her arms, and she ran towards, together with the community, towards the caves in the nearby mountain, which is also called Baba, or grandmother. And they hid in these caverns in the Baba mountain for several months before they fled onwards on their journey of forced removal from that space. When I did some archival research, I noticed that this fleeing into Baba Mountains and those caverns is also traditional. So we have narratives from the First World War of a certain Jula Dizdarevich, who also writes about the community fleeing into those caverns. So there is this sort of also now almost traditional, one could say, a cycle of kind of fleeing into those spaces. And the generations whom I spoke to, they embodied this landscape in terms of knowing also when to hide and how to hide from the violence. They embodied the waiting for Elijah's day. They understood the importance of, for example, kumstvo connections, which is a particular form of ritual kinship, which was established in this space almost exclusively between Orthodox Christians and Muslims. So it wasn't inverted into the community, into the religious community, quote unquote, but rather it was established between these ritual religious communities. So there are many forms of these proximities and connections that form part of a certain bodily knowledge for my interlocutors. And in their constant references to this landscape of proximities and encounters, I understood that it suggests a certain form of resistance to the nationalist violence. It sort of created a specific time space. I refer to time space through Mikhail Bakhtin's work, a work of a Russian linguistic philosopher. He talks about chronotopes, the merging of time and space into particular themes. And what my interlocutors, for the most part, did is they referred to this time space of encounters of the annual cycle. So this kind of temporality related to the annual cycle as fixed to the landscape of Gatsko, and then they contrasted it to the time space of the nationalist field and the nationalist Gatsko. And in doing so, they resisted the workings of the nationalist time space. They suggested that the survival of this sacro spatial frame of their community.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, and I think you call kind of the result of that contestation or maybe something simultaneous with it, like a schizochronotopia of these kind of contrasting or contradictory time spaces. So I'm wondering if you could talk about kind of what is a schizochronotopia and what does living in one look like in the field?
Thank you. So when I started with chronotopes or time spaces, for which Bakhtin says they are, you know, well, in this kind of merging of time and space, and he was writing about literature, and he was writing about chronotopes in the novel primarily, and he wasn't referring to this sort of wider cultural possibilities of employing the chronotope. He says, time thickens, takes on flesh, space becomes charged and responsive to the movements of plot and history. And so the spatial and temporal indicators for him are fused into these carefully thought out concrete holes, right? And so when I, what I noticed about the politics of time spaces in the field of Gaskell is that there are these two grand time-space themes. One, which I called Sacroscape, because it builds upon and references this sort of annual cycle rituals and encounters between those communities and wider encounters with mythical beings and so on. And what I called Ethnoscape, not in reference to a padurai, but more in line with how Anthony Smith referred to them as landscapes endowed with poetic ethnic meaning. So this sort of nationalist theme of time space, which is populated with martyrs and heroes and warnings of suffering and a time space which insists on the homogenization of the ethno-national body. So in noticing this rift between these two grand themes, these two grand time-space topics in the landscape, I also noticed that people willy-nilly have to kind of bear them and live both of them in the same body, in the same landscape and in the same individual body. So I coined this term schizochronotope or schizochronotopia from the Greek schizane to split. So it is really about a split between these two overarching themes, chronotopic themes. Not that there are no other chronotopes out there, but these were two grand dominant chronotopic themes. And they both relied on certain kinds of past. They both laid claim to certain futures of the field, but there was a divergence into the kinds of past that they constructed and into the kinds of futures that they wished. Now, diverging past, diverging futures, yet in the same landscape. And how does one sort of reconcile and negotiate between those two grand themes? And at one point in the book, as I'm writing about articulations of home, and I'm going back to these hundreds of hours of recordings of my interviews and my notes and scratch notes and so on, I noticed the endings of those conversations. And I really started to pay attention to the endings and certain breaks in the conversation, and I started sort of taking them out of the interviews and translating them separately. And what I notice is that very long, very evocative, rich narratives of how it used to be, of this past, of encounters, of the annual cycle and so on, of this landscape populated with faces, with song, and so on. Oh, landscapes which appear idyllic, so they're certainly idealized also, they would suddenly break into the present. And so these rich, evocative narratives would suddenly break. They would break into a long sigh or a sip of coffee or a pull on the cigarette. And these sentences are unfinished. They're broken. And what I noticed or what I thought about these moments is that they're moments of transposition from this past landscape or this past chronotope into the present chronotope, into the violence of the present chronotope. And it is really in this transposition where those two chronotopes met in the same body and sort of where they became articulated for me as a researcher. And they really became articulated through those silences. So they were not completely articulable at all. And in a sense, so I related this to Elaine Scarry's research, who argued that physical pain might resist language, but also that it might shatter language or deconstruct it into pre-language of sighs and groans and so on. And for me, this silence in the field and this brokenness of language as a response to the present seemed like an inability or a bodily refusal to continue to protract these unwanted horizons of the present. So language and body sort of articulated then a refusal, a resistance to this chronotopic nationalist theme, to the ethnoscape. And famously, for those who read some anthropology, Keith Basso studied silence in Western Apache, amongst the Western Apache communities, and the instances when they give up on words. And he argued that silence, much like speech, required sort of the knowledge of channels and codes of communication, and that it responded to certain situations. And it is this form of silence and the brokenness of language, I think, that best articulates the process, the post-war process of sort of this friction, this uneasiness, this split between the two chronotopes. In a way, they're sort of striving to erase each other, striving to forget each other, yet they're both there in the same landscape, in the same body.
Thank you for that. So I want to switch gears now a little bit and talk about you, because I think you do such an amazing job of talking about yourself in this field. So I take it that you're not originally from Gatsko or that area, and yet you say that the field spills into you, and you say that that you eat Kaimuk differently after the field. So I'm wondering if you could talk about, kind of, on the one hand, what the field did to you, but also the process of then representing that in this research, in this book, how that came about and how you negotiated that.
Thank you. It's a complex question that anthropologists are struggling with in different ways. And I think, I was not born in Gatsko. I was born in a small town in northern Bosnia, which is now a district, so DC, Brčko, which lies on the river Sava. And my family is from various parts of Bosnia. And in that sense, even though much of my education, certainly my postgraduate education, my MPhil in Cambridge and my PhD in at Goldsmiths University of London, and my work for the most part is in the UK. I am Bosnian. I am from Bosnia. Actually, I was born in Yugoslavia, so slightly different country. But I am Bosnian. And there was an important question for me, and really one that I tackled and struggled with throughout the writing and afterwards, and I think it's really important to struggle with these questions. How close is Gatsko? How close to home is this home that is, or homeland, language, and so on? And I think it's very important to struggle with this question. On the other hand, I think it comes too often, too easily, an assumption of a certain kind of detachment and objectivity for people who were not born in the countries where they do research. This is, I think, much more dangerous, this idea that of detachment. I struggled with this. Now, I also, now in anthropology, as many of the researchers and anthropological listeners to this podcast might know, there was that reflexivity turn, sort of a turn towards the researcher, which asked for the researchers to understand both their positionality, their own particular histories, their own power positions and so on in the field, but also sort of to reflect upon their own histories, their own thoughts, their own experiences in the very formation of the research question. What is it in my life? What is it in my experience? What is it in my histories that produces this research interest, this research question, and so on? And certainly, one of the formational experiences for me and for many anthropologists and other social researchers or researchers of the social working in Bosnia, the formational experience in one way or another is that fracture of the 1990s war. Again, when we started this conversation, I noted to you that for me, this research question is about how can we reconcile the disassociative violence, the nationalism, and the rich histories and present-day communication between these religious groups, between people more generally. And this question relates to my experience of living in Sarajevo during the siege, of living together with people more generally, but people of different kinds of persuasions, religions, and so on. And understanding also through my family histories, yes, the richness of these encounters and communications and their articulations. But when I arrived to Gatskom, I understood that it will also take much learning in the sense of those things that are presumed to be known to me. Learning in terms of the language. I mean, every 2 minutes I asked, but what does this word mean? And they would say, well, izjes is a type of oak dust that we put in pillows for fertility and sexuality in the bedroom. And, you know, so language was filled, and of course, very different to what I came to know by growing up for the most part in Sarajevo and sort of an urban environment and so on. And in many different ways, and certainly Elijah for me was not part of my sort of life history before then. When Elijah and Gatsko's landscapes and this annual cycle, St. George and the dragons and the nymphs and the fairies and epic songs, when they entered my life, they also sort of transformed the ways in which I relate, not only to Gatsko, but to other spaces. So my friends right now will know that in Hampstead Heath, close to where I live now, there is Elijah's oak, a very specific grand oak. Now, oaks are related to Saint Elijah as the thunderer. Oaks are generally related to thunder gods and thunder-related sort of mythical beings. I think there was even one study that suggested that oaks would attract lightning much sooner than other trees in an open space. So they have been related, of course, to various sort of Indo-European beings and to Elijah, who is the inheritor of the Slavic thunder and so on, the Slavic thunder Perun. Now, in thinking about these intimacies and the kind of the knowledge that changes the interlocutor, I think it's the most important question is really how does this ontological, so this experience, this to a certain extent embodiment of that landscape, of those narratives, but also an understanding of their situated meaning, how does it oppose an epistemological challenge? How does it change the kinds of questions we ask, the kinds of conceptual frameworks that we employ? And this is how I arrived at the anthropology of proximity. This is also how I arrived at the anthropology of affect, even though conversations on affect are much more developed now in that sense. But really sort of finding and refining these conceptual tools based on the kind of intimacy of knowledge, intimacy with that landscape, this was very important to me.
Thanks. Yeah, and I think in general in the book, that's really evident. But in particular, in the second part of the book, which is called The Many Faces of Elijah, where you kind of follow lines of flight, I think is maybe one way to put it, in a way that in some sense is a kind of academic writing. Certainly it's at the level of writing as the rest of the book, but also, and I think you say, kind of that you open questions and don't necessarily answer them. So you take us through kind of toponyms, you take us to Palestine and to Visoko and to all of these different places, in a really kind of exciting, sometimes a little bit of a whirlwind, but I think overall quite enjoyable way. And so I wonder how this second part of the book, which I think is called like what is it? The epic, or it's the poetry of the landscape. Sorry, I've lost my notes here.
So the Gatsko Georgics, the Georgics are the poetry of landscape. Yes, of course. Thank you for mentioning it. It's for me, the second part of the book is very important. Now, various readers, and I've had the pleasure of having various interlocutors in the writing up stages, and later on, before the publication of the book, some of whom even suggested that perhaps the first part of the book and the second one should be published as separate books. It's the second part is a long, winding journey, and through the many faces of Elijah, which then one learns are also the many faces of George, and which lead not only through these faces of Elijah in the field, and there are many faces in the field of Gatsko itself, but then the iterations of these mythical characters, of these encounters and their struggles with various kinds of political programs in Bosnia, across the Mediterranean basin, and as you mentioned, in Palestine. And Palestine, in that sense, it's a different articulation, but there are similarities in the sense that St. George, or Hidr, this green sort of saint prophet of the springtime, is also positioned against the kind of the forms of ethno-nationalism and exclusionary politics as a form of resistance, perhaps much more explicitly than in Bosnia and in Gatsko. So the many faces of Elijah, it can be read first rather than second. So if you haven't read the book and you're deciding now, based perhaps on this podcast, to read it, you can also start from the second part of the book, because it is a particular kind of context which I thought was necessary to counteract some of the conversations in the first part. The first part is called Time and Its Discontents. And it deals with various questions of the temporality of home, of the temporality as related to the destruction of this annual cycle and so on. But it's always positioned in this kind of post-war sense. And it refers, of course, because people themselves do, to this fractured landscape. Now, as I said, these narratives of my interlocutors, before they would break into the present, they formulated a very complex sort of cosmology, a very cohesive cosmology, which I thought, based on these conversations, should not be encapsulated only and bound only to this post-war transitional space, but rather needs to be understood and should be valued also as examples of a very developed cosmological conversation, relationship to landscape, and so on. And when I started writing this chapter, it really took off, and then it did not want to end. And it's a very, very, very long chapter. And it's precisely because those connections, those encounters, conceptual, mythical, everyday, and so on, they continue, and they have very long histories, and they're wide spatially. And so one could trace St. George hither from the Indian subcontinent to the British Isles and find those similarities, connections, and so on. There are very surprising in the amount of continuity, really, and similarity, but also in the iterations and particular contextualizations that one can perceive. So the Gotsko Georgics, here in reference to Virgil's famous Georgics, they start with compiled narratives. I started this chapter with 10 scenes of St. George's Day, and end the chapter with 10 scenes of St. Elijah's Day. Now, between St. George's Day, according to the Julian calendar, on the 6th of May, and St. Elijah's Day, according to the Julian calendar, on the 2nd of August, there is this whole warm season of labor, but also various apotropaic rituals, connections, and so on. And the field is in many ways articulated there. These 10 scenes, in these 10 scenes, you will see a conversation between my various interlocutors on the meanings of trees, on certain rituals descending down to water springs on St. George's Day, and so on. But these are constructed conversations, or to a certain sense, they're not confabulations, but they are constructed in the sense that I construct a conversation between people who are divided by the predicaments of migration, post-war separation, and so on. So it really is there that I construct the conversation from my conversations with individuals into sort of a group conversation, and then continue venturing into these iterations of St. George, Hidr, the Green One, and Elijah, and their various importance for other landscapes across Bosnia and outside of Bosnia. And what one sees there is that Hidr and George and Elijah are these syncretic anti-nationalist figures par excellence, that they really are encapsulating this this resistance, this fight against exclusion in many ways. So when I visited Palestine and Israel, which was as much as it was beautiful, also difficult an experience, I was really searching for those places related to Hidr, related to St. George, related to Elijah. And for example, in Al-Lud, in or Lida or Lod, near Tel Aviv, this magnificent structure, which is an Orthodox monastery on top of a Byzantine crypt, but also a part of the same architectural complex as the mosque, all dedicated to St. George and Hidr. So the mosque is the mosque of Hidr, Prophet Prophet Hidr, the green one, and the monastery is of Saint George. Underneath, in this Byzantine crypt, is George is said to be buried, and this space is visited by Christians, Muslims, and others, particularly women, who pray for fertility, because George, as this vernal saint prophet, is also one granting fertility, miraculous fertility to land, to people, and so on. Now, in Bosnia, if you travel into almost any locale in Bosnia, you will hear narratives of St. George's rituals related to fertility. And when young women on the morning of St. George's Day descend down to water rapids to engage in a ritual called Omaha, and they unclothe and they bathe there, they also are watched from nearby bushes or behind trees by young men. They know that these young men will attempt to kind of sneak a peek at them washing, but they are also quite sort of performatively angry about this. Later on, the same men will, on St. George's Day, will try to steal their virginal flowers or miloduch from their front doors or from their gardens. Symbolic kind of meaning contained in these rituals is really one about fertility. And the dragon, which is part of the same narratives, part of epic poetry, part of songs, always attempts in these songs and stories to steal the maiden, to steal the young woman. Now, the dragon appears, if we read carefully these myths, appears as a symbol of infertility. So it is really between the kind of the fertility symbolized in St. George or the young man in these rituals and dragon, who symbolizes infertility, that these maidens, mythical and real, negotiate between life and death. And their rituals will very often occur exactly in these places where life and death meet, or where the ketonic, the underworld, and the world meet. So close to inside or close to caves, close to those places where water rushes into the underground, and so on. So there is a very complex cosmology that requires analysis, but need not be articulated anthropologically, simply in terms of the violence of the 1990s or nationalist violence more generally. So this was my way to sort of balance what occurs in the first part of the book.
I think it's quite appropriate to begin to conclude where we began, at the karstic landscape and the river that emerges and submerges. So thanks so much for chatting today. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you're currently working on.
Thank you so much, Dino, for inviting me for this podcast. And I know you're doing some amazing anthropological, geographic research yourself in Sarajevo and Istanbul. And I very much hope that we can talk more about your research soon as well. As I said, I'm working teaching at SOAS, University of London. It's one of these teaching positions that requires a lot of teaching time and leaves very little time for what I would much rather be doing right now. And this is a fieldwork that I engaged in or conducted some preliminary investigations for in another stunning field along the Dinaric mountain chain, Popova field, which is currently separated into two political entities. And for those who know some of the political geography of Bosnia after the 1990s and the so-called Dayton Peace Agreement, Bosnia is divided between the so-called Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. Both of these entities are produced or based upon ethnic homogenization, and then the district of Brzeszów, which is where I was born. Now, this field where I'm conducting the preliminary investigations in is divided between those two political entities, yet this river that I write about, this river that actually starts in Gatsko, my previous field site, it emerges in this new field, Popovo field, and attains, again, cosmic significance. And so my research is sort of builds upon and connects through this sinking river really to a new space, cosmological space and karst space. I have also recently written about these shared and syncretic saints, Elijah and George, as they appear in the most unlikely of spaces, and this is the archives of the ICTY, or the International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, which closed its doors last year. And these archives contain many references to shared saints, but shared saints appear very often as an unacknowledged unacknowledged reference by those witnesses who attempt to explain Bosnian social life and relations. Yet the sort of the paradigm of Bosnian social relations in the tribunal, despite the fact that it really is the ethno-nationalist war criminals who are on trial, who produced kind of this and this ethno-national logic, the paradigm of the tribunal and sort of the legal expectations of the tribunal are articulated through ethno-national forms of belonging. So what we see in those archives and in those conversations is that law has a very difficult time hearing what the witnesses are saying. So St. Elijah's Day is, of course, misspelled in 20 different ways. And we have the same question repetitively asked, you know, about Elijah's Day. So they ask one protected witness, yes, but why is this 2nd of August? You remember that you were placed into a refrigerator van and taken from your home into another location and then gang raped with other women. How come you remember that it was the 2nd of August? And she says, well, it was the 2nd of August, St. Elijah's Day. Ilya until noon, Ali afternoon. That's what we used to say. So she narrates this kind of life. Then we see that same question appearing again a bit later on in the interrogation. We see the same question with a different spelling of Elijah's Day appearing for another witness, another protected witness. It, you know, these interventions based on shared life into the ICTY are made, but they appear as a certain kind of debris that is sort of outside of the legal paradigm. So that and quite a few other things I'm doing at the moment, but I'm very much hoping to go back to some long-term field work, as anthropologists would say.
Excellent. Well, I'm excited to see what comes soon, and I commend listeners to also read your article, Syncretic Debris, that you mentioned in Ethnoscripts, a really excellent piece as well. Safet, thank you so much. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us again. Our Twitter, if you want to talk back to us, is @newbooksgeog. And the book is Waiting for Elijah, Time and Encounter in a Bosnian Landscape. It's by Safet Hadžimuhamedović. It was released in 2018 by Berghahn. And we will see you next time on New Books in Geography.